for tuning into the Alpha Woman podcast. Today, I'm interviewing Rebecca Brown, the founder of Crowns Consulting, a full-service consultancy for the global cannabis industry. Crowns is writing the playbook for cannabis marketing and designing solutions to grow cannabis brands within the constraints of regulation. Rebecca has a decades-long career in marketing and advertising, with a track record of innovation and building new scalable agency models. Prior to founding Crowns, she was the vice president of social media and content at J. Walter Thompson. Before we jump into our fascinating interview and hear about Rebecca's very interesting career, which, by the way, started as a director and producer of theater after graduating from New York University with her Bachelor of Fine Arts, I ask our guest to provide me with an inspirational alpha woman. And this week, Rebecca chose Patti Smith. There might be that New York connection there. Very interesting. Patti Smith is an American singer-songwriter, musician, author, and poet who became an influential component of the New York City punk rock movement with her 1975 debut album, Horses. Called the Punk Poet Laureate, Smith fused rock and poetry in her work to become a true original, an avant-garde thinker and artist who many considered having produced one of the first and greatest punk rock albums of all time. Horses is now viewed by critics as one of the greatest and most influential albums, not only in the history of American punk rock movement, but also in the history of all rock and roll. It has also been cited as a key influence on a number of succeeding post-punk and alternative rock acts, including Susie and the Banshees, R.E.M., The Smiths, P.J. Harvey, and Hole. Patricia Lee Smith was born on December 30, 1946 in Chicago. The eldest of four children, Smith was a tall, gangly, and sickly child with a lazy left eye. Her outward appearance and shy demeanor gave no hint of the groundbreaking rock star she would become. However, Smith says she was always knew that she was destined for greatness. Quote, "When I was a little kid, I always knew that I had something special inside me," she remembered. "I mean, I wasn't attractive, I wasn't very verbal, I wasn't very smart in school. I wasn't anything that showed the world I was something special. But I had this tremendous hope all the time. I had this tremendous spirit that kept me going. I was a happy child because I had this feeling that I was going to go beyond my body physical. I just knew it." As a child, Smith also experienced gender confusion. Described as a tomboy, she shunned girly activities and instead preferred roughhousing with her predominantly male friends. Her tall, lean, and somewhat masculine body defied the images of femininity she saw around her. Smith attended Deptford High School, a racially integrated high school where she recalls both befriending and dating her Black classmates. While in high school, Smith also developed an intense interest in music and performance. She fell in love with the music of John Coltrane, Little Richard, and the Rolling Stones, and performed in many of the school's plays and musicals. Upon graduating from high school in 1964, Smith took a job working at a toy factory, a short-lived but terrible experience that inspired Smith to write her first single, Piss Factory. Intending to become an art teacher, she enrolled at Glassboro State College, but she didn't fare well academically. So in 1967, with vague aspirations of becoming an artist, Smith moved to New York City and took a job working at a Manhattan bookstore. After arriving in New York, Smith famously met and started a relationship with a young artist named Robert Mapplethorpe. Although their romantic involvement ended when he discovered his homosexuality, Smith and Mapplethorpe maintain a very close friendship and artistic partnership for many years to come until his death. Smith, a prolific poet, had experimented earlier with setting her poetry to music and began to more fully explore rock and roll as an outlet for her lyric poetry. In 1974, she formed a band and recorded, as aforementioned, the single Piss Factory, now widely considered the first true punk song, which garnered her a sizable and fanatical grassroots following. The next year, after Bob Dylan lent her mainstream credibility by attending one of her concerts, Smith landed a record deal with Arista Records. Her 1975 debut album, Horses, featuring the iconic singles Gloria and Land of a Thousand Dances, was a huge commercial and critical success for its manic energy, heartfelt lyrics, and skillful wordplay. Rebuilding her act as the Patti Smith Group to give due credit to her band, Smith released her second album, Radio Ethiopia, in 1976. The Patti Smith Group then achieved a commercial breakthrough with its third album, Easter, propelled by the hit single Because the Night, co-written by Smith and Bruce Springsteen. I had no idea that they co-wrote that song. I mean, I know every word and every bar of that song. Smith's fourth album, 1979's Wave, received only lukewarm reviews and modest sales. By the time she released Wave, Smith had fallen deeply in love with MC5 guitarist Fred Sonic Smith, and the pair married in 1980. For the next 17 years, Smith largely disappeared from the public scene, devoting herself to domestic life and essentially becoming a housewife, raising the couple's two children. She released only one album during this time, 1988's Dream of Life, a collaboration with her husband. The death of her beloved husband in 1994 finally provided Smith the impetus to revive her music career. She achieved a triumphant return with her 1996 comeback album, Gone Again, featuring the singles Summer Cannibals and Wicked Messenger. The artist remained a prominent fixture of the rock music scene with new albums from 96 onwards, proving that after 35 years of music and 11 albums, she remains an ever-evolving and prolific musical talent. One of the pioneers of rock music and punk, a trailblazer who redefined the role of female rock stars, a poet who unleashed her lyrical talent over powerful guitars, Smith stands out as one of the greatest figures in the history of rock and roll. After four decades, Smith finds her continued motivation to write and make music in the unfairly shortened lives of her loved ones and the needs of her children. Quote, "The people I lost all believed in me, and my children needed me. So that's a lot of reasons to continue, let alone that life is great," she says. "It's difficult, but it's great, and every day some new wonderful thing is revealed. Whether it's a new book, or the sky is beautiful, or another full moon, or you meet a new friend, life is interesting." And now, a message from our sponsor, Green Market Report. The Green Market Report focuses on the financial news of the rapidly growing cannabis industry. GMR's target approach filters out the daily noise and does a deep dive into the financial business and economic side of the cannabis industry. The GMR team is cultivating the industry's critical news into one source and providing open source insights and data analysis. For more information, visit greenmarketreport.com. And now, on to our interview. Hello, Rebecca Brown. Welcome to the Alpha Woman podcast.
Hi, Leslie. Thanks so much for having me.
It's such a pleasure. So how are you today?
I'm okay today. I'm excited to be talking to you. Any conversation outside of the humans who live in my house is novel and welcome.
It's a very good point. I do feel the same. So let's just jump into it. Now, I wanted to ask why you chose the incredible Patti Smith as your inspirational alpha woman.
It was such a hard question to answer. Like, I really struggled with it because there are so many, I'm inspired by so many women. I guess I feel like, how could Patti Smith not be? I don't understand how anyone could not be inspired by Patti Smith. She's just such a weirdo punk badass. And I guess, like, you know, I have a lot of heart and take a lot of inspiration from people and women who are just, you know, making up their own approach and script to life. So to me, Patti Smith is just a person who's just always done what she wanted to do. So she's like just a highly productive weirdo and a reinventionist. And Horses that album has been on repeat in my life for decades now.
Yes, I know what you mean. She was one of those, along with kind of like Debbie Harry when I was a teenager, who was incredibly influential, I would say, in my life. And you're right, like a woman who just led her life by her own playbook and didn't give a fuck what anyone else thought. Yeah. Love her.
Which is so hard. Like, I think, like, she is a weirdo. Like, she is not, running anyone else's script. She is not, would not have been acceptable to a lot of, you know, people in power, and, you know, has had this incredibly productive career and gotten so much shit done.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Thank you very much for choosing her. That was awesome. So I guess maybe a little, a part of that, of course, of the New York scene, you went to New York University and obtained your BFA, Bachelor of Fine Arts there. That must have been a pretty fun experience. Talk to us about that a little bit.
Yeah, it was crazy fun. So I was what, like, kids today call a drammy in high school. So I was like, I was a theater nerd, and I went to Claude Watson, which is a performing arts high school here in Toronto. And then I was like incredibly fortunate in that I was able to go to NYU and live in New York in the 90s and like see Lou Reed walking down the street.
Oh, cool.
So yeah, so I have a BFA in theater. I wanted to be a director. And I did direct in Toronto, New York for a number of years. You know, which I actually think, like, I think that I really think that arts training and theater training, like rigorous theater training, it really sets you up to do a broad variety of things, because it's very disciplined, but B, it teaches you a disciplined way to think about narrative and structure narrative, which is really not radically different from marketing and advertising, right?
Right, the storytelling.
Yeah, it's all narrative. Like, brand is narrative.
Right. Interesting. And so did you actually have a career path in mind when you went into fine arts?
I had a career path in mind, but I was like 19. So like in my mind, what was going to happen was I was going to, you know, take the avant-garde theater world by storm. And I was going to, you know, grow up and be like, you know, Robert Wilson or Laurie Anderson, and, you know, live this amazing art world life. And I directed, like, I directed in Toronto, New York for a number of years. And then really, like, my segue from theater into advertising was like strangely organic. I had supplemented my artist's income for years by writing articles, by writing for papers, and also by working for experiential advertising companies, marketing companies, because experiential and theater are really, really not very different from each other. And so I had those, I had that experience, and I had also been self-producing plays, which teaches you 100, I mean, you're running a business, like, wow. It teaches you a lot of things. And then what happened was I had my first baby, and I was in this informal sort of artist coffee meetup group, which was like moms and dads, because we were all freelancers who'd recently had babies. And there was like nothing to do sort of before all of the brands and businesses that exist now around parenting culture had happened. And so I was like, well, I know how to do things. And I started throwing events at the Drake Hotel that you bring your baby to. And you know,
was it the baby disco events?
Yeah.
Oh my God. I went to some of those, Rebecca.
That's awesome. Yeah.
I was a hip downtown mom too in the early 2000s. Well, our bared children are the same age. So that's so funny. Yeah.
Yeah. So those were like crazy cult events. Like you couldn't get into
them. Yeah. Yeah. Those are awesome.
So I did that. And then we launched like an online magazine, if you will, that was about parenting, but about parenting in a different way. Like it wasn't like, here's how to sleep train your child. It was like, here's how Tamara Davis, who's, you know, married to Mike D from the Beastie Boys, cooks for her family, or, you know, so it was like, it was really about bringing your lifestyle and your parenting lifestyle together and being creative with kids. So we did that. And we had relationships with CPG brands who were advertisers and sponsors of our events and our content at precisely the moment that those companies started to be interested in social media and long form blogging and content as a form of marketing and advertising. And their agencies of record had no experience whatsoever doing that kind of stuff. So we were like, well, we can do that for you. And that became my first agency. And very quickly, not surprisingly, the service arm of that business quickly eclipsed, you know, ticket revenue and ad sales revenue. And we really became an agency, like where we beat, we were McCain Foods' first social media and content agency of record. Like it scaled and grew very, very rapidly. So I ran that for about 5 years and then sold it to another agency, became a partner in that entity. So that's my story.
What an interesting thing. So you went from a fine arts, someone who perceived yourself as a fine arts, someone who's going to be an alternative, you know, really kind of in that fine art world, to becoming a businesswoman.
Yes. But if you scratch the surface of a lot of successful agency folk, you will find drama nerds. They are everywhere, again, because it just teaches you so many things about narrative and really also about business, because you have to self-produce if you're in that world. You have to learn how to do that.
So all the business things like cash flow management, handling money, managing staff, contractors.
Well, like so many business fundamentals are learned through doing that.
Right. Very, very good point. And then you've had a really, you know, stellar career in the field of marketing. So after running your own businesses, and then you sold it to another agency, and then what happened?
So I was a partner in the acquirer for about 3 years, and then that agency was acquired, and I stayed through the merger. And actually that was sort of when I started to become interested in and started to very closely follow what the movement towards legalization of cannabis in Canada, because one of my colleagues in that agency was following that space, and his name is Simon Davies, and he later went on to be one of the founders of Starseed. So I stayed through the merger, and then I was wooed over to J. Walter Thompson to help them launch a content and social media practice. And you know, I think at a time where larger agencies were really starting to see that their smaller and more nimble competitors were, you know, taking a lot of business from them and wanted to figure out how they could, you know, borrow some of the, you know, the mojo from those small independents. So that was my role at JWT. But while I was there, I also brought Starseed in as a client through my friendship with Simon. And we did all of the foundational brand architecture and design work for Starseed. JWT was actually the first large agency to have a cannabis client, but wouldn't announce it because they didn't want to alienate you know, their conservative CPG clients, which is funny because now if you don't have a cannabis client, it's very not cool. It's like, it's not acceptable to not have a cannabis client, but they were the first. So I was at JWT for 3 years. I think that was like my only, probably the, my only job where I wasn't in any way an owner of the company. And it was actually a delightful experience where I learned like a ton. I was really a self-made, self-taught, you know, guerrilla, you know, marketer, advertiser. So that I really got to spend time with people who were lifers and had grown up inside advertising and was exposed to the rigors and the, you know, the history of advertising and of brand planning. So that was, it was really a delightful couple of years. But it became pretty clear to me, especially through the work that we were doing with Starseed, and I was very excited about the opportunity with cannabis in Canada, both as someone who had been a long time recreational user and because as someone who's just attracted to, you know, big shifts in culture, it also became clear to me that large agencies were really not the right fit for the needs of this burgeoning industry, which I felt really needed partners who were deeply specialized in the space and really understood the regulatory environment, the impacts of capital markets on day-to-day operations, the difficulty of supply chain, like all of the things, in order to provide good counsel, and that they also needed partners who were really nimble and agile and could be like, yes, everything has changed from this week to last week. No problem. We'll just, you know, we'll start again. And those are two things that big agencies are really not good at. So I felt like there was a really strong need and value proposition for a more nimble and specialized cannabis agency. So after 3 years, I left JWT to launch Grounds.
Okay, excellent. And so now talk to us a little bit, you know, as you just mentioned, the regulations around marketing cannabis in Canada, as wonderful as this as this federal legalization structure is, it can be very frustrating. However, you know, as I heard you once say on stage on a panel, when there are big challenges like this, there are also really big opportunities to be very creative. So can you talk to us about these restrictive regulations, but you know, how do you see that enabling creativity? So what have you done that's like really creative, even though there are so many restrictions for your clients?
Yeah, so I do really believe that. I think that creativity loves constraint. But I also think that, unfortunately, we aren't at a. I wish that regulation was the barrier to. I don't feel like we're at a place right now where regulation is really the problem. I think that I think that it's been such a roller coaster, and there's been so much, you know, distraction. I think it would be hard to point at a brand or a company where you could say, you know, those guys have really exhausted every possible thing you can do. They've really put in the time and the rigor day over day working within regulation to reach their customer. I feel very few brands have done that. And I think that's because we've been on this roller coaster of, operational problems confusion or the tension between our stakeholder being the capital markets and our stakeholder being a consumer. So I don't think that most companies are organized against the proposition of, you know, the consumer and delivering something specific and delightful to the consumer and have, you know, tried in a concerted way to reach them even within the constraint of regulation. Mm-hmm. So like to me right now, the barrier is mostly it's culture, it's and it's operation from most companies.
Are there any that stand out for you that are doing a good job on the consumer branding standpoint?
Yeah, I think that Superette is doing a really good job. I think that's a company that has, like, from the get-go, has known that they exist for a consumer and has put in the time to really, really understand and iterate their offering and perfect it to delight that consumer. And they've been super focused on that. And I think that that's what's required. I think that, you know, as the fog sort of starts to lift from the space, the companies that win will be companies that are organized around brand and consumer, and most companies aren't. And that kind of leads me to wonder, you know, what, for companies that have been around for 2 years and have, to a certain extent, an established internal culture and set of priorities, I don't know how easy it would be for those companies to make that, like, significant pivot and reorganize themselves around brand, customer, delivering a consistent value proposition to a specific consumer, right? Like, it's really hard to change a behavior that's already ingrained inside an organization. So I think there are significant cultural barriers to those companies getting to a place where they even start to hit the problem of regulation.
Right. Right. And I did find, or observe that a lot of cannabis companies, especially LPs, they seem to have this idea of vertical integration just never made sense to me, because if you're a cultivator and you know how to grow cannabis really, really well, it doesn't mean you know how to retail cannabis really, really well, or you know how to train bud tenders really, really well. So it'll be really interesting too to see how it all shakes out and how the companies focus on what they do well.
Totally, absolutely agree with you. I think, and then I think that the upside of that is it really is still anyone's game. And a new company that enters the space with a very clear idea of where there is an unmet consumer need and is organized around solving that, and that's it, and that's all that they care about, I think has as much, if not, you know, a better shot than companies that have kind of churned through, you know, we're this and now we're that and now we're another thing, right? Where both their internal teams are exhausted and confused, and the consumer is also exhausted and confused by their behavior.
Right, right. And so with COVID-19, we saw this sudden sort of acceleration here in Ontario of online retail, essentially, or allowing retailers to have their own online stores. So how do you think that could change marketing, particularly for those retailers?
I think it depends on whether that continues to be a thing. I think that it's, you know, it's been extended slightly, but I think that if that continues, if retailers are able to own more of their digital ecosystem, it gives them greater opportunity. Fundamentally, I think that retail is a much easier, it's certainly not easy, but I do think it is in many ways an easier brand building opportunity right now than product. Right. It's easy. It's simpler for the consumer to understand, right? Like, if I go into your store, I am literally inside your brand. I'm inside the experience of it. It's a much more direct relationship. So it's much easier to articulate, and make clear what you stand for and what your value proposition is. Sure. I think the ability to own more of the digital piece of that means certainly that those retailers will be able to understand and know their customer in a much deeper way, because they'll start to see the data returns from those interactions, and can have a more wholesome broader ecosystem relationship. So I think it strengthens what I think is already a pretty tantalizing opportunity for retail.
Right. And you think that could be clawed back as a decision after COVID?
who knows? I think it's really hard. It's hard. Like once the genie's out of the bottle, it's hard.
Yeah.
But you know, and who it could happen. Hope it doesn't.
Right. So diversity in the cannabis industry is a big issue, especially in leadership positions. Now, this is not restricted only to the cannabis industry. However, you know, as time goes on, it seems like becoming more and more entrenched, difficult to change. And especially as it pertains to women and, you know, even worse, people of color, women of color, have a challenging time accessing capital, which may be part of why that situation exists. Do you think it's possible to create a diverse and inclusive industry? And why is this important? And what steps do you think we can do to do this?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's fair to say that cannabis, I mean, I think statistically, like by the numbers, cannabis underperforms even industries like mining and oil and gas and financial institutions from a diversity perspective. We are an exceptionally non-diverse industry when we look at the composition of boards and of C-suites. And it's something that, that I find exceptionally disappointing as someone who entered the space in part because I felt like Canada had this unique opportunity to build a powerful new industry, but also an industry that was maybe, you know, better and a little more fair than what had gone before. And I think objectively that is not what we are seeing. Do I think it's possible to build a diverse cannabis industry? Of course it's possible. But people would need to make that a priority. And it is difficult, like once you set certain things in motion to shift gears, board seats last for a long time. But, you know, on a certain level, it's hard, but it's not complicated, right? Like the way to have a more diverse board and a more diverse C-suite is to just have a more diverse board or a more diverse C-suite, and to make that a priority when you're doing outreach for those roles and those positions, because, you know, it is absolutely true that there are highly qualified women and highly qualified people of color who can occupy those positions. And it's also true that companies that reflect diversity make more money. They're more successful companies.
Well, I think that that's the data that needs to be shared and needs to be reinforced. Is it just, it actually makes smart business decisions, business sense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not just the right thing to do. It's the right thing to do from a business perspective and from a dollars perspective.
Yes. So how has your business been impacted by COVID?
Well, we certainly have been impacted by COVID. So, you know, but we've seen like a slowdown. We've seen contracts that were signed are now delayed by a number of months. Having said that, I feel very grateful to be working in an industry that is largely recession-proof. So I think compared to friends, entrepreneur friends who are working in, you know, entertainment, travel, or food service, I think I really can't complain. Like we still have money coming in. It's not as much money as we were seeing pre-COVID, but we will survive. We've actually seen an uptick in the past 2 weeks, which has been sort of interesting. Like some projects have restarted, and in some new inbound stuff. Mm. So I think I'm very grateful to be working in cannabis at this time. I also think that and this is like, I'm like, should I say this? I also do think that COVID is perhaps hastening the demise of companies that were going to crumble over the course of 2020 anyhow.
Yeah.
I think a lot of us really saw 2020 as, even pre-COVID, like as a year it was going to be a year of reorg and of reckoning and of consolidation and of bankruptcy, you know, of market correction. And if that is being hastened by COVID, that to me isn't necessarily a terrible thing, right? Like I'd like us to get through that and be in, you know, and be in the, you know, sort of the new day where the companies that are in it for the long haul and weren't here for, you know, quick 2-year payout, but want to build something and want to operate, where that's who's left, because that's who I want to work with.
Absolutely. That's a very good point. And another thing that I'm observing is that there's sort of a speed up of the acceptance of cannabis as a product that a lot of people want to use. And, you know, the fact that it has been deemed an essential service, that the stores need to stay open. I think people's minds, the stigma is maybe vanishing quicker than it wouldn't have done if COVID wasn't here.
Totally agree with you. Yes. I think that's right. And I also think that, you know, from an economic recovery perspective, it will, you know, we need to embrace sectors and industries that can create jobs. So I think, I think that there will be deeper acceptance coming out of this. I think that I hope that the industry will have more powers to advocate to government for you know, for itself and for, you know, fair and equal treatment. And I see no reason why those things wouldn't happen.
True, and it was impressive to see that the industry come together around the retail situation and actually see change that came about, you know, because the industry did collectively demand a change.
Absolutely, yes.
Yeah, that was very nice. So do you think this global pandemic can have any positive outcomes in general? And if so, what do you think these might be?
When there's change, there can always be positive income. I can only speak from a very personal lens, like where for me as a person who, you know, has been a builder of businesses and, you know, an entrepreneur for decades, you know, while that lifestyle tends to be highly romanticized, the reality of it is you really work a crazy number of hours in the course of a day, and there is absolutely no work-life balance, and you do sort of get into like a very, like, you know, where you're sort of flogging yourself all the time to like work harder and hustle harder and be more productive. It's been interesting for me to be in a situation where, you know, hustle, you know, through this period was really not going to make any significant difference.
Right.
And, you know, so I had to pull back from that and like start to do different things and be more balanced. And, you know, I've become a very avid ping pong player, and I'm doing like cooking and baking. And there are pieces of that more balanced, you know, community, friend, family focused way of living that I wouldn't want to give up and go back to sort of the insanity of the feeling that limitless, you know, that there is limitless growth, and the only way to access limitless growth is through limitless work. Yeah. I think that's incorrect thinking. That's sort of my takeaway. And, it's not unique. I think many people are feeling that as well.
Well, what's interesting is if each household does that, that could radically change a lot of things.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I mean, I kind of think that like the religion we've all bought into for the past, you know, I don't know how long really is this like hustle porn culture. I think it's been a contributor to the rise of, you know, anxiety and mental illness. And I also think that it's allowed us to like dehumanize lots of other things and other endeavors. So I think that there's a lot of there could be a lot of positive shift just in terms of a backing away from the hubris of, you know, endless opportunity for those who work 20 hours a day, just a gentler, a somewhat gentler way of living where we're kinder and more empathetic and more appreciative of each other.
Yes. Yes. So what's the first thing you want to do when we can, you know, go out and sort of be free again?
The first thing that I want to do is hug my parents.
Aww.
And my nephew. Yeah. In particular, like definitely my parents, but my nephew lives with my parents and we do, he's not quite two. We do porch visits with him. Aww. And he's like really mad at us because he doesn't understand why we come over, but we won't come in the house, touch him, pick him up, play with him. Like he's like pissed off. So I feel like we need to like repair that relationship, my parents are older and, it's, you know, it's been hard. I would really like to give my mom and my dad a hug.
Yeah. Same. So Rebecca, there you are at home and, you know, it's difficult being quarantined. So how do you take care of yourself physically and mentally, these days?
Well, I would say, Leslie, I win some days and I lose some days.
Yeah.
I find when I'm able, and I fail at this completely sometimes, like maintaining some semblance of schedule, and the bar is low, is good. Like consistent waking time and sleep time makes a really big difference. I'm running, which has been great because I have more time to do that. We have a ping pong table in our basement, and I never played. Like I was just not into it at all. And I have, you know, I was like that kid in like grade school who was just always terrified to be picked to be on any team where you had to do anything with a ball.
Yeah.
But I've been playing a lot of ping pong, and I'm finding that ping pong is actually, for me, extremely meditative because I'm not very good at ping pong. And so in order to play, I have to be, I have to be absolutely present. And if I let my mind wander into the future or the past, I immediately screw up. So that it's shocking. Like I was very surprised by how like brain clearing a good kind of ping pong rally can be. And I'm also, you know, we have kids who are the same age. My daughter just turned 12 actually on Saturday. So my kids are 12 and 15. And to me, the other silver lining of being quarantined is like under normal circumstances, my kids basically spend all of their time trying to escape the house and be with their friends. But they're stuck here with us. So we have this gift of this like couple of months of closeness with our teenagers, which I can't think of any other circumstance that would allow that to happen.
So true.
In their lives. So I'm really appreciative of that, even though they're pretty grouchy to me, but I'm still, doesn't matter. It's still time together.
Absolutely. No, time is the most important thing that we have. In fact, currency that we have in our lives. So I totally understand, and I'm feeling the same way about this time with my 15-year-old son. You will never get it back, and it's so valuable.
Yes. What's the first thing you want to do when you can go out and be free again?
Well, it's pretty much exactly what you said, you know, hug my parents. They're like yours, they're both in their late 70s, or I don't know if yours are, but they're both elderly. And then have a family event. You know, I've got 5 siblings, so I just have a big, big old dinner and have all the little cousins running around, and just that feeling again that we haven't been able to have. And I think there's just so much anxiety around elderly parents and making sure that they're healthy. You know, so I hope that we can do that soon, but we also want to keep them safe. So that's definitely, it's all about seeing my family. And then after that, of course, my amazing friends. I mean, just to go for a barbecue at my girlfriend's place where I can see all my friends and hang out and, you know, have some wine and dance and, you know, smoke some weed.
Are you doing any like porch visits, like distance visits with your friends?
Very rarely. I've only done one to go pick up something that was mailed, but we're definitely really staying very isolated. I live in a condo, so we don't have that kind of neighborhood porch thing. So we haven't done that. Yeah.
I would say the other thing that I really want to do is we have an extremely committed pot banging tradition on my street.
Oh.
Everyone is out every night at 7:30. And so I would really like to have a potluck with the pot bangers. Like I think that would be amazing. Cause that 7:30 like pot banging many days is the best part of my day.
Well, you feel the energy of humanity.
Totally. And we're all in it together and
yeah,
all of that good stuff. But it's it's pretty awesome. Like, so we all come out and we bang pots, and then there are little kids who do they dress up, which is really funny. And then we bang, and then someone says good night. And on Fridays we announce which week it is. It was already like a very friendly street, but I feel like it'll be even more close knit coming out of this. I also, because I've turned into a stress baker, I sometimes drop baking off like door to door because I'm baking more than my family can consume.
I wish I was your neighbor.
It was good baking, but it is baking.
Well, I'm sure, and it's also the love that goes, I'm sure it tastes delicious. And you know what, what you also just said is something amazing that would be like a great outcome of this whole experience.
Totally.
Yeah. Well, Rebecca, I want to thank you so much for being my guest today. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you.
To you as well.
Thank you. And we'll talk to you soon.
Awesome. Have a great rest of your day.
Stay safe. Bye-bye.
Okay, will do. Bye-bye.
If you're looking for other podcasts to help take your mind off things and keep you feeling like the fierce alpha woman you are, one of my new favorites is Ronan Farrow's Catch and Kill. This is journalism at its finest, a not-to-be-missed podcast about taking down Harvey Weinstein and also dismantling the toxic patriarchal power structure. And as always, thank you to our partner, Green Market Report. Their target approach filters out the daily noise and does a deep dive into the financial, business, and economic side of the cannabis industry. For more information, visit greenmarketreport.com. If you enjoyed this podcast, please rate us on iTunes, and don't forget to leave your feedback and subscribe. Follow us on social at Alpha Woman Co. for your daily dose of Alpha Woman, or visit us online at alphawomanco.com, become a member, and subscribe to our newsletter. Thanks again for listening. See you next week.